Jenna Silber Story is a senior fellow at American Enterprise Institute, where she and Ben Story lead AEI's Project on the Future of the American University. She is co-author with Ben of Why We Are Restless on the Modern Quest for Contentment, which we covered on the podcast a few years back. Today, we will discuss a report Professor Story co-authored, again with Ben, of Civic Thought, a Proposal for University-Level Civics Education. Welcome, Professor Story.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for having me on the podcast.
Generally, what would you say is the state of civic education in higher education today? Where are we?
That's a great question. I think we're at a transitional moment. I think if you look at the history of civic education in the United States, it's been done in different ways at different times. And it's usually changed form every, say, 20 or 30 years. So you might say that civic education in the 19th century was embodied in the capstone course typically offered by the college president on moral philosophy that helped students think about how their education would prepare, had prepared them to go forth in the world and act as citizens, as members of a profession, members of their communities. This is a brief history, but after both World War I and World War II, there were moves to create general education courses that would attend in a different way to prepare people intellectually for the life of citizenship. Intermittently during those times, there's also the move that was spearheaded by research universities and their priorities to think about the citizen as effectively a kind of scientist. What could social scientists, science studies, and other kinds of scientific studies tell citizens about how to think about their civic duties and problems? And then most recently, I think civic education has taken the form of service learning. So it's been a much more active, participatory kind of education. And I think right now we're seeing a pretty widespread agreement that that service learning isn't a sufficient form of civic education. I take my bearings here from Ron Daniels' recent book, What Universities Owe Democracy, in which he says service learning had its part, had its proper place in the university, but it really doesn't intellectually prepare young people for the life of citizenship. And I think he is representing a pretty widespread sense that service learning isn't adequate, and therefore a search for what might be adequate. So into that kind of mainstream intellectual uncertainty about the value or the sufficiency of civic learning, I think steps very interestingly a set of projects coming from both within and without universities, coming from generally red state legislative initiatives or boards of regents in red and purple states, who have recently launched 13 schools to address the question of civic education to help educate students in civic education in a way that has not been done in universities in the recent past. And so I think it's a very interesting moment for civic education in the country right now, because I think there's a lot of potential for these red state initiatives to join forces with blue state discontent and initiatives on their parts to produce something really, really new and potentially enduring.
So just quick, service learning would be something like a school requiring in a semester 10 hours of volunteering work at some organization, you know, in the proximity. Is that right?
That's one form it could take. It could also take the form of pre-law students or even law students offering like clinical services to the community. A lot of times the volunteering that you're speaking of is tied with some kind of academic component, you might say, usually reflection on what that volunteering means and some sociological studies and so forth. But I think the point that President Daniels is making, and that is really picked up not only in the work that he's doing at Hopkins, but I think even more ambitiously in the work that a lot of the people in the Red State Initiatives are doing, is that we actually need to be informed about what citizenship is, what the history of self-governance has been, its successes, its failures, you know, from ancient Greece onward, what our particular institutions and laws and practices and customs are and why they have been shaped the way they have been shaped, and how, you know, what the current system is like and how you actually act well within it. These things are not sufficiently being taught to students. And I think there's, again, opportunity for a reformed kind of civic education to do that a lot better.
You noted a moment ago, a couple times, that while some college leaders recognize the deficiencies here, I mean, even just, you know, preparing young people for the you know, the marketplace of ideas and debate and free speech and so on, which a lot of kids just haven't really absorbed. But the most ambitious project have been taken up by in the states. Is it the governors or is it legislators, you know, the state house or Senate that is leading the way on this? Certain governors good on this?
I think you probably is the case that in each state it's a bit different mix of people. The first project in this that started this trend was launched in 2016, actually, so 8 years ago, and that was in Arizona. And at that time, Governor Doug Ducey, along with the state legislature, and I believe the president of ASU, Michael Crow, decided that something like this needed to happen. And so as far as I understand, they worked together to launch this thing and to find the director for it for seven, 8 years. Paul Carice, who was a former professor of political science at the Air Force, directed that program. And I think it's quite interesting that the School of Civic and Economic Thought and Leadership, as it was called, has been running for, you know, 7-8 years, and it was the only one of its kind for most of that time. And really, just about 2 years ago, other states started to take notice and to launch programs of their own. So either sometimes it's the legislature leading the way, sometimes it's the Board of Regents, as is in the case at the University of Texas at Austin and University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I think the initiator varies, but the effort that we see as very important here, and what our piece really speaks to, is the effort to translate this political and social energy and concern wherever it is coming from, whether that's university leadership or political leadership in the legislature or the governor's office, to translate that into an academic program, because that is how it's going to actually exist on campus, and that is actually crucial to its success. So it's strategically very important to make this an intellectually integral program, and actually to prove the place of civics in the university, we say, as a discipline among other disciplines, since that's how the contemporary university is organized.
That's really, I think, one of the great strengths of your report, is to go into the intellectual foundations, the academic nature of civics education as a discipline, and one that deserves sort of equal status of other fields. I mean, we've had these centers opening on campus, conservative centers of different kinds, a lot of them being political science, civics oriented, but they haven't really had the same status as the English department, right? Or the physics department. You think we've got to make civics, we've got to make these centers to have that disciplinary status if they're going to succeed. Big recommendation on your part? And if so, what are some of the key features that those centers would have to have?
That's a good question. You're right that I think a lot of smaller programs, beachhead programs, as they're sometimes called, have been called, have been started by conservative academics or academics who are intellectually conconservative at various schools around the country. My husband and I directed one such at Furman University, the Tocqueville program, and so we know very well what that's like. And I think they, you know, those have great effect. They reach a lot of students, but they're usually kind of short-term projects, I think, is what we're seeing, because they depend on a department. So they're usually housed within a department. And insofar as the department has kind of goodwill toward them, they exist, but they often tend to expire after a generation or so. And so structurally, they weren't organized as independent intellectual units. And that was, you know, initially I was just interested in this, as that's a problem for their longevity as a practical matter. I think what's really significant about what's going on in Arizona, Florida, Texas, North Carolina, Tennessee, Ohio, and some other states that are developing, is that these legislatures or Board of Regents have launched independent academic units. So they have the status of a department or a school. They have the same kind of relative autonomy or independence in terms of faculty hiring and in terms of curriculum, right? So that's not absolute autonomy. Of course, this all goes through faculty review boards and things, but it's really different to be part of a department who can decide whether or not to replace a retiring professor in your program and to be your own independent academic unit that gets to propose your faculty candidates to the relevant, you know, administrative structures in the university. And I think that's, you know, it's structurally important, but it also comes with, it really brings into focus this question of why should these be independent academic units, right? What is the real justification for that? Not just the strategic justification, but what is the authentic reason why you need to study civics in a different department, as it were, or a school? And I think there's, you know, this was an open question for Ben and I when we began to think about this. And I should say we've talked about this with lots of different people, all of the leaders of these schools, as well as people at Hopkins and Stanford and Harvard and Yale and so forth. So this isn't, you know, we've learned a lot from a lot of people on this question. And I should mention also from Peter Levine at Tufts. You know, we're not sure about whether civics should be its own discipline at the beginning. And the more we think about it, the more we think it should be. We think there is a particular perspective on phenomena that thinking like a citizen brings that is not systematically represented or trained in any other discipline. And to me, that's the mark of what it means to innovate in the academic world in a kind of integral and authentic way. And if I might explain exactly what I mean by that, I think you might see, you know, the fact that we don't systematically train young people, we don't systematically train people in this country to understand what it means to think like a citizen, and therefore to try to be better at that kind of thinking. You could see that very dramatically during one of the last crises our country faced with the COVID pandemic. Right, it was a challenge. No one knew what to do. And our reflex was to consult experts, right? And that's not a bad initial step. But then I think most people became kind of flummoxed about what next. And it devolved into an argument about, do we follow usually medical experts or do we distrust them, right? That's not the question of a citizen, right? A citizen faced with a collective problem consults experts, but then recognizes that a political decision cannot be made by any particular form of expertise, right? So a good citizen would consult the medical experts, would consult the experts in education, would consult the experts in mental health, the experts in the economy, and so forth. It's useful to get these opinions, but then those people need to, as it were, step off the stage, and citizens need to take that information and debate among themselves about what is best for this country to do. And I think that brings a couple things that no expert view brings into sight. And one that is that citizens make a normative judgment about human flourishing. They're saying doing this will set the conditions to make life marginally better for most people here. A good political thinker has to not just be concentrated on one form of the good, but on many different forms of the good at once. You have to hold all the goods in your mind at once, as Jennifer Frey says when talking about political prudence. A good citizen also realizes that he or she needs to make judgments with other people, with other citizens that are necessarily going to see things differently. They have different economic situations, geographic situations, religious beliefs, what have you. There's a lot of difference, and you need to learn to make those decisions together. And third, political judgments are oriented toward action. So the question is, what should we do? What should we do together? That is what political questions are for. I think we confuse political questions all the time with theoretical questions, and that actually makes our politics much more divisive than it needs to be. I think the question, what should we do, can actually illuminate political phenomena in a way that existing disciplines don't generally do.
You know, there is one section where, when you're talking about the content of civics education, I think you actually take an ingenious and clear-sighted approach. Civic knowledge. Okay, what counts as civic knowledge? You say, well, let's look at what our government does. And federal, state, and local. And out of that, we can derive some some formation of citizens. So if we have, say, a Department of the Interior setting out environmental regulations, and this is one example you give, citizens need instruction in, quote, your phrase, the proper relationship between human beings and nature. So, and there we can go to different thinkers. We can go to the books, but it really begins by looking at what our government is doing, and the citizens then need to understand what our government does. But again, just not looking just at policy, but deeper ideas, right? Deeper conceptions of human beings and nature. I think that is your original idea, yours and Ben's original idea. It's really good.
Well, thank you.
I think it is an ingenious way of building at least part of the curriculum of civics education.
Well, thank you. I'm going to give credit to Ben for that particular idea. He was the one that pushed that initially. I'm sure it's not absolutely novel, but it was one of the first things that he proposed when we began to think about this question. And I think it is, I think it's quite important. I think one of the things that he was meaning to argue in making this argument is that civic education is often seen as something that exists below university life, as something that should be in K-12.
High school subject.
Yeah, exactly, right. And I think a lot of people, particularly from the right, think, you know, go into this argument with the rhetorical approach of, oh, this should have been done in K-12, but our schools are failing, so we got to do it in college. That's a terrible way to try to introduce something to either students or faculty. The fact is, and it's also just a false way to think about civic education. The fact is, the challenge of being a citizen is a really extraordinary challenge. It is a noble profession, as Peter Levine says, and it is something that is worthy of really ambitious and minds. And so it should not be portrayed as remedial. And so when Ben was trying to flesh that contention out, he was saying, look at the kinds of things that citizens are asked to deal with in some way, to grapple with in some way as questions. Everything the government touches on, you have to learn how to ask questions of people that are experts in, you know, the environment or what have you, right? You're not going to be expert in all of these fields. You can't be. But you need to be conversant with their basics, and you need, ideally, to be able to ask questions and make decisions about these things. It's kind of what we want, I think, from a liberal education a lot of the times, right? So at first, it looks just like preposterous, like, how could you possibly do all this? And then you think, well, actually, this is how we often talk about a liberally educated person. Right, someone who is able to ask good questions, to try to understand subjects that they're not intimately familiar with, try to engage in discussions with others, and try to make judgments about what is best or what is due or what to do or what is most likely true, based on what they've learned.
Yeah. In a way, the civics education, just the breadth required there, really runs against the research university, which is its push for specialization. Right, for expertise, as you put it. I think it might be nice if civics education sort of brought generalist understanding of things. It'd be nice to get a lot of some of those civics education courses into the general education courses as well. Civics education, though, isn't even though you're talking about the deeper questions, it's not like a great books program, right?
I would say that's right. And I think if I might address your first remark first here, I think that civics education should be part of general education, should be something that every student at a university does. And I mention this because we often get this question, wait, are we going to hive off civic thought in a department or school? And that means no one else in the university like gets to learn how to be a citizen. No. But I think we have the best chance of having a really, well, even having a requirement to do this, let alone having a really good requirement to do this, if we have people who are devoted to thinking about this, you know, full time. I mean, if you think about our requirements, they often are tied to existing disciplines, or they're promoted by existing disciplines. So I don't think it's a trade-off in either or. I think, as you said, civics education should be part of general education. And then you asked about the relationship between civics education and great books education, which, of course, can be done in all sorts of different ways. And I think there is a really integral relationship between civics education and great books. And I think that when I think about what it takes, what it typically takes to be a great book, at least in my view. And I've been largely trained in what you might call great books programs. A great book is one, I think, that doesn't slice human phenomena up into small pieces and presume that one can consider one part of it without taking on the challenge of thinking about how that part relates to everything else, relates to the whole. Now, that is a, you know, I think you see really great minds, capacious minds, are able to do that in a way that is, you know, is extraordinary. I mean, I think that's what makes them great. We're just astonished by minds that can do this thing. And I think what those authors are typically showing us is that this is something that human beings really have to do in order to be honest about the work of the intellect. And it is also something that we have to be aware that it is, you know, basically impossible for the human mind to do. We can never really grasp the whole with perfect certainty, but this effort is part of what it means to think. So I think insofar as great books education is putting works like that before young people and causing them to think about what we call synoptic, what we're causing them to engage with whom we call synoptic authors, or to think like discipline generalists, as we call them. I think great books education is really an important part of civics education. Sometimes great books education can, very often it is not directed towards questions of action. What after doing all of these studies of the tradition or of these great minds, you know, thoughts about the whole, what does that tell me about how to live? And how to live with other people, and how to live with other people in our moment, given our particular complexity of problems and opportunities. Very often, we don't make that transition to that question. Ben and I all found that in our own teaching, and this is really part of what motivated us to think about something like civic education or rethink what liberal education might be in order to be more, in order to encourage something like prudence more. That's another project we're working on. Is that a lot of times great books education just gets kind of stuck in the books, and it can encourage the perspective of a social critic or someone sitting on the sidelines or just overwhelmed by history and not able to think about how one might act well within it.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned thinking a moment ago, and you got a little section on critical thinking, which is so often held up as the goal of liberal education. But You say at one point, actually, the critical thinking may, quote, undermine effective citizenship. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think at its best, critical thinking is meant to help people assess whether other arguments are valid or sound. And that is obviously an important part of thinking. But that in itself is not sufficient to think like a citizen, because you can reject certain arguments and accept others, and that still doesn't add up to a good prudential response about what to do with other people. A lot of times, critical thinking, the term connotes something far beyond that kind of epistemological effort that I just mentioned. I think just the term encourages people to think of themselves as primarily critics, as looking at what they've been given and figuring out what is wrong with it. And that is, at best, just one phase of trying to act well within the world. And I think it has overtaken, it has often overtaken much of thought. And I think we might be more attentive to this as it manifests itself on the academic left, which is much of the academy, because they talk quite a lot about things like social criticism and revolution and ruptures and things like this. But I think it's also embedded in some core documents that the academic right has embraced, such as the Calvin Report. And this is really interesting and important to me. I think the Calvin Report is a very useful document. I think the point about institutional neutrality it makes is very important and should be embraced. But I am troubled by the way that it talks about the purpose of the university. The Calvin Report says that the university as an overall institution shouldn't be a social critic, right? Therefore, institutional neutrality. But that is because it should be a home for social critics. And is that really the purpose of the university? I mean, we are effectively saying, you know, that what the university is for is to incubate social critics, to be, as it says, like Socrates, upsetting. Okay, so we're telling our students, you know, if you're here, you're supposed to be an upsetting social critic. Well, I think we're reaping what we've sown.
I'm so sick and tired of hearing about we need to challenge. We need to upset people. We need to make them question their beliefs. But it's so overdone, And you actually take the contrary of that as a significant part of civics education, and that is summed up in the word love. What is the love factor in civics education as you envision it?
Well, I guess we put that in there because we think that to really change anything for the better, you do need to love it, right? And I think you can see this in, most people can see this when they reflect on their own lives, say their children, right? If you just go after your kids about everything they're doing wrong, they are unlikely, and you look at all the negative things that are going on in the household, it is unlikely to change for the better, right? You really need to be invested in what you're trying to improve in order to make it better. And I think to look at it with sort of eyes of love is to look at the thing that you want to improve in order to find its best and most lovable parts, and to encourage those, to try to help those parts grow and hopefully crowd out, you know, the things that are not as good. So I think it's important to be attentive to what's not going well and what's negative, but if that takes the lead, you are actually unlikely to make that thing better.
Agreed. Last question. Is civic thought your preferred name for the major?
That is the preferred name, and I think for us. And we have lots of discussions about this with other people, and you can find it embedded in the Arizona project and in some other projects, but not everyone's calling it civic thought. I think civic thought is important because thought indicates that civics is not just about action. There's an academic or an intellectual component that's very important. I would consider civic thought and practice to be a potential name, but you know, landing on something that seems to make our point briefly, we've landed on civic thought.
That is the name of the report from AEI, American Enterprise Institute, Civic Thought, a Proposal for University-Level Civics Education. Professor Jenna Story, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for our conversation.